Tonight, University of the Air begins a new series of lectures on contemporary psychiatry given by Dr. John Lovett-Doust. For the next 10 weeks, Dr. Lovett-Doust will describe various psychiatric disorders and their causes and discuss treatment and prevention. He'll trace the roots of contemporary psychiatry from earliest times and examine the changing attitudes of society toward its mentally ill. Dr. Lovett-Doust is professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto. He's done a great deal of original research in his field and has made psychiatric education a special concern. Tonight, in his introductory lecture, he clears away some common misconceptions about contemporary psychiatry. Dr. Lovett-Doust.
In these talks, I'm going to try to tell you something of psychiatry, the study of the suffering of human minds, of the nature of the disorders affecting the mind, their genesis, their methods of expression, and their impact on society. In doing so, I know that I shall be in danger of involving you with me in these sicknesses. And at least if you don't see yourselves, you may seem to see certain of your relatives and friends in one or other of the conditions I shall describe. Try not to be alarmed or disturbed by this. It's common indeed for the medical student to feel the same thing about himself as he learns of new diseases. And he gets over it as his objective interest in medicine quickens and he learns to stand outside the disease surrounding him. To help you in this effort, I propose to introduce you only slowly to the patients who form the clinical substance of psychiatry. And as a token of this, we shall not actually hear a case history of a patient until 2 weeks from now. As the study or practice of people showing abnormal behavior, psychiatry is a specialty of clinical medicine. Its practitioners are therefore doctors, physicians who have qualified themselves by at least 4 years of recognized training subsequent to obtaining their medical degree and license to practice medicine. The study of normal behavior is the province of psychology. Psychologists may hold doctorates, but these are PhDs and not MDs. The distinction between psychologists and psychiatrists only tends to overlap when the two sorts of doctors engage in research programs, when these sorts of distinctions just don't matter, or when the psychologist extends his interest into the field of abnormal psychology. And here the boundaries may become blurred indeed. Broadly, the psychologist is a natural scientist and the psychiatrist a medical man. But the psychologist is also sometimes a practicing clinical psychologist in the field of abnormal psychology, sometimes even a therapist rather than a scientist at all. And this can be confusing for the layman. A similar confusion sometimes arises in connection with psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis refers to a body of knowledge introduced by the psychiatrist named Sigmund Freud, who was born in Vienna in 1856 and died in England in 1939. He was a genius and was responsible for much of the fundamental psychiatric knowledge we now possess concerning mental processes. His discoveries were based on painstaking clinical observation of his neurotic patients and the results of his therapeutic experiments on them. As no other man before him, he described a structure for the psyche, or mind, in every way comparable to the physical anatomy of the brain itself. And he also evolved a number of psychological theories to explain behavior. Theories of psychodynamics, as these are called. Deviations of normal development of the psyche, according to Freud, result in psychopathology, or disturbance of normal mental functioning, and may at the same time determine both the nature and the pattern of a neurotic breakdown. Freud's discoveries extended far beyond medicine. He enlivened the understanding of social and cultural anthropology, education, and even religion and ethics. Yet his championship of sex as the prime source of his theories of libido, that is, psychic energy, of instincts, of repression, and of infantile development cost him most of his friends and psychiatric colleagues. He applied these theories to conscious and unconscious mental functions, and this provided him with an explanation of dreams and the meaning of the symptom in neurotic reactions and mental disorders. They enabled him to set down the principles of the theory of psychoanalysis, while his clinical experience with the treatment of neurotic patients led him to a technique of psychotherapy which consists of free association and dream analysis, and is also called psychoanalysis. All this was excellent. It represented in the earlier years of our present century such an enormous advance that Freud's discoveries in psychiatry have been compared with those of Galileo and Copernicus in the physical sciences. Unfortunately, two events marred their brilliance. The first was the effort of Freud's followers. Many of these, unhappy with the exclusiveness and rigidity of his system, progressively broke away from him. Jung, Adler, Frank, and Steckel were among the most famous of these rebels, and each proceeded to set up his own reasonable explanation for Freud's facts. So devastating to the psychoanalytic movement were these defections that the orthodox Freudians were forced to close their ranks and consolidate their forces. They created national and international associations and institutes to preserve the rigid doctrine and to excommunicate disbelievers. Freud's writings were regarded almost as the books of some psychological Bible, and the psychoanalysts, the fundamentalist interpreters of them. The other event was Freud's own doing. He yielded to demands to sanction the use of the term psychoanalyst to apply to suitably trained lay people who were not physicians. This opened the door to the creation of non-psychiatrist psychotherapists, a decision bitterly opposed by many psychoanalysts today. It was a decision that was to lead to confusion of the analytic image in the public's mind, which tends to assume that all analysts are psychiatrists and vice versa. It also led to a certain hesitancy among psychiatrists, especially when the question of exact medical diagnosis of the patient's malady was in doubt. Perhaps the most fundamental psychiatric objection to psychoanalysis, however, lies in its exclusive claims. It's contributed much, so much that the cupboard of psychiatric knowledge would be bare indeed without it. But there are other preferable explanations for many psychiatric states, other preferable therapies than psychoanalysis for a majority of patients, and other ways of regarding psychiatric illness than the ones proposed by Freud. And we shall have occasion to consider these alternatives later in the course of these lectures. The helping professions in the areas of mental health represent a complex organization. Ideally, in a clinic or hospital setting, the psychiatrist heads up an expert team, each member of which has a specific task to perform. A key member is the clinical psychologist, to whom we've already referred, and whose tests and mental measurements tap the resources of the personality of the patient, winkling out his strengths and weaknesses, the nature of his intelligence, his attitudes and emotional balance, his behavior under stress, and so on. Another key member is the psychiatric social worker, whose principal task is the appraisal and remolding of the environment in which the patient broke down. Now, this is a fulsome challenge, for environment is an inclusive term. Not only does it consist of the people important to the patient and his breakdown, such as his parents, brothers and sisters and other relatives and friends, his spouse and his children, his employer and the various grades of colleagueship of his fellow workers. Not only these, but it includes also his social and economic status, his debts and his assets, the place at which he works, the home in which he lives, and the transportation he uses between these areas. The spare time world of his leisure hours, his evenings, weekends and vacations, his hobbies and vices, his church affiliation and his activities, his relative preference for fantasy enjoyment, passively at his TV or movies, and how actively involved he tries to be in actual games, bowling, curling, and the like, as opposed to photography, stamp collecting, or knitting. And these are the kinds of inquiries the social worker makes about the environment. Other team members are the psychiatric nurses and occupational therapists. And outside the psychiatric team proper, but bearing upon it like the spokes of an organizational wheel, are a wide variety of social and community agencies, specialized clinics, rehabilitation resources, volunteer organizations, and so on. A word now about the terminology of psychiatry. It's a curious reflection that people who take no exception to the bastard words and often esoteric jargon of other sciences object violently to the language of psychiatry. Yet terms like cybernetics, the chemical names of drugs and other compounds, the new semantics of nuclear physics, genetics, engineering, and other sciences are introduced not to confuse, but rather to render more meaningful concepts which cannot be given scientific precision without them. And so also, inevitably, with the sciences of the mind. As long as we are forced to deal in generalities, psychiatry can't advance, either in its capacity for description or in its classification and measurement. And since these are the very bedrock of the scientific approach, psychiatry cannot realign itself with medical science and share in the advances that medicine's making so triumphantly in the treatment of medical disorders without them. In these lectures, we shall keep away as much as possible from the specialized language of psychiatry and attempt to explain such technical words as have to be employed as we go along. But such a language is as much one of the basic necessities for psychiatry as it is for medical science in general. It exists, therefore, not to confuse, but rather to enlighten, and I hope you'll try and appreciate this when it occasionally becomes necessary to employ terms with which you're unfamiliar. We shall attempt a definition of a few basic terms here in order to provide ourselves with a frame of reference for discussion, but we'll leave the remainder to be picked up as we come across them. The ones I've chosen are those used in psychiatry all the time, and I hope they'll serve as examples of what I've said about clarity and precision. First, then, let's consider the word emotion. This is a common enough term and one in everyday use. You yourself, I'm sure, will have your own private meaning for it. However, in psychiatry, emotion is a syndrome. And at once we must break off and explain what this is. Syndrome is a word used in internal medicine, and it's defined as a cluster or pattern of symptoms or characteristics believed to have a common basis or cause. So we may infer technically that emotion is not one thing, but a cluster of characteristics with a common basis. The word doesn't refer only to the subject's prevailing mood or spirits, not only either to his affect, that is, the amount of energy or valence of the feeling state, not only also to the behavior of the individual, as to whether his face blanches or blushes, or his hands tremble or sweat, or his legs start running to carry him well away from whatever it was that provoked him. And neither only, again, to the complex series of physiological and other bodily changes occurring simultaneously. These are the body's adaptive response to the stress of the emotional experience. An emotion is not any of these things separately, but a syndrome of them all, and therefore a very complicated experience indeed. One, in fact, that involves nearly every organ and tissue in the body. By sifting out its various elements, it becomes not only possible, but also quite practicable, to find out what's gone wrong in any particular patient. And emotion is the psychiatrist's peculiar concern, because some disturbance of it will characterize every single patient he'll see. I mentioned and defined the word affect a minute or so ago. You'll recall that it refers to the amount of energy invested in the mood aspect of the emotion. Because of the basic relationship of emotional energy to psychiatric disabilities, these emotional and mental sicknesses tend to be referred to as affections. Most psychiatric illnesses are not diseases in the strict sense of the term, because a disease is a syndrome with a known cause and usually involves a structural change in the organism, that is, a pathology. This is actually true of a few rather uncommon psychiatric conditions, organic brain syndromes, syphilis of the nervous system, senile dementia are some examples of psychiatric diseases with definite structural pathology. But for the very common majority of affections, it's not true. Most are caused by many factors, and a person's immunity to breakdown depends upon his native physical and psychological strengths and their reaction to the stressful elements of the environment as the patient perceives it. For reasons such as these, therefore, the psychiatric breakdown is spoken of as an affection, or sometimes simply as a reaction, in contrast to the various infections, malignant growths, and the like that we see in organic medicine. So, we have the neurotic or psychoneurotic affections or reactions, the psychotic affections or reaction types, and so on. Let's now look at these two terms. Psychosis is a fairly easy term to define. It's any specific, severe mental disorder which has a characteristic origin, course, and constellation of symptoms. Usually, the patient's judgment is rather grossly impaired in a psychosis, and he may be in danger of doing harm to himself or to others. Psychosis is loosely equivalent to the legal use of the term insanity. Loosely also, a neurosis is the equivalent of what you may have called a nervous breakdown or a state of nervousness. It's primarily a functional emotional disorder, but there may well be organic factors involved. In general terms, it can be regarded as the end result of the interplay of three sets of forces: the genetic inheritance and constitution of the person, his early life experiences, which led him to a characteristic stress response pattern, and the nature of his later life experiences and the problems they brought with them. European psychiatry in the past placed most emphasis on the hereditary aspect. The Freudian analyst in America still regards the early child experiences as the critical factor, while the followers of Pavlov in Soviet psychiatry and the present cult of existentialism, with its emphasis on the here and now aspect of encounter, each favors the overriding nature of the current problem. Contemporary psychiatry favors a judgment involving all these factors, but grants a greater or less importance to each in accordance with the knowledge and needs of the individual patient. In essence, a neurotic affection is an instance of maladjustment of the individual to the personal environment in which he lives. It's a very common affection indeed, so common, in fact, that for some psychoanalysts at least, it's not a question of either neurotic or normal, but rather how neurotic is everyone. And they do have some justification for this point of view, for every person has his breaking point. This leads us straight into the problem of what is mental health or psychiatric normalcy. It can be fairly easy to define physical health, especially if one's willing to couch it in negative terms. For example, the absence of structural disease and its symptoms. But this statement doesn't help too much for mental health. Actually, it doesn't provide a really acceptable description of physical health either, for it's repeatedly been estimated that between 30 and 75% of patients who report to doctors and hospitals for treatment of physical complaints are really suffering from psychiatric affections. Mental health is a relative concept, and any standards set for it will depend upon the education, culture, social and economic status, and sophistication of the population. What is considered to be healthy behavior will vary also in accordance with sex and age, occupation and religion, and even a person's rural or urban domicile within such populations. Thus we can talk not only of the mental health of individuals, but also of entire cultures and societies, and by the same token, of their sickness also. What is mental health? We must face the fact that no exact or scientific criteria exist to categorize it, and that the borderland between mental health and mental illness is ill-defined indeed. Yet earnest humanitarians talk about it, educators attempt to raise our children by it, and even government departments use the term to describe their activities on its behalf. If the truth be spoken, we know far less about mental health than we do about mental illness. We could, for example, make a list of all the desirable qualities we might wish to have for men and women, and call their totality mental health. We might say that it represents mental poise, calm judgment, qualities of leadership and good fellowship. In other words, cooperation with an attitude that tempers justice with mercy and humility. Or alternatively, we might claim that it's everything that militates against industrial unrest, against crime and other antisocial activities. More positively, mental health has been defined as the totality of values such as democracy, cooperation but not dependency, ambition without selfishness, success but not at the expense of others, happiness and the capacity for joy rather than pleasure. And the list could be lengthened endlessly, but what does it really mean? As a statement of the Protestant ethic, it would probably have many supporters, but there is no evidence whatsoever that such value judgments and pious protestations bear any proven relationship to mental health. And until we know much more about health, it's probably preferable to settle for the statement of a wise old psychiatrist and leave it at that. Out of the wisdom of his lifelong experience, Ginsberg said, "Mental health is the ability to hold a job, have a family, keep out of trouble with the law, and enjoy the usual opportunities for pleasure." In any event, the whole idea of mental health sprang from our knowledge of mental illness. In our next lecture, we shall trace the evolution of this knowledge through the ages. We shall see how it was gained by the enthusiasm of a few gifted psychiatrists, and then lost again as the pendulum of public opinion swung to reverse the humanitarian changes they proposed. We shall be sickened by the number of times this pendulum has swung, but encouraged that throughout the momentum of reform has ever been increasing. In fact, the gains of enlightenment were finally consolidated at the beginning of this present century, when, sparked by a disgusted schoolteacher, Dorothea Dix of New England, documented by the searing personal account of an ex-inmate of an insane asylum, Clifford Beers, and fanned by a Canadian, Claire Hinks, into a conflagration which spread around the world, the mental hygiene movement was born. Today, mental health associations exist in all civilized countries. As well as promoting education, sponsoring improvement in legislation and the like, these associations are self-appointed watchdogs on behalf of the mentally ill. Never again must the helping efforts of the few be crushed or reversed because of fear, mistrust, or bigotry. Never again must the mentally ill be dubbed second-class citizens. As a psychiatrist, I have often heard psychiatry criticized, and it's instructive to look at some of these criticisms. For example, psychiatry is taken to task for its attitude towards religion. Charges are sometimes made that psychiatrists are seeking to destroy religion or their patients' religious faith. And critics may point to one patient who gave up his regular church-going practices around the time of his psychiatric illness. Other insinuations concern the psychiatrist's alleged inclination to tamper with the morals of his patient. It's been suggested, for instance, that certain persons undergoing psychological treatment have been known to undertake illicit sexual adventures with a freedom which is alien to their history, and which, for their friends and relatives, appears quite remarkable. And since psychiatry and the experience of these well-wishers is equated with sex and the music hall version of the analytic couch, what else can you expect? Now that our Sarah has ruined herself by visiting that dreadful man's office so many times, what else is left for her? Allied with these charges is the assumption that Sarah herself, and not just some of her distorted attitudes and neurotic ways, that Sarah herself can be changed and a new Sarah created in the psychiatrist's image. And for these and similar reasons, the psychiatrist today is regarded by some as a free thinker, by others as a disturber of public morals and a perverter of the innocent, and by a few as a magician of seemingly limitless powers. And of course, these charges are just not true, as we shall discover in a later lecture when we look at the nature of a person's mental mechanisms. All that the psychiatrist can hope to reveal to the patient is a measure of what's in her mind already. All that he can dispel is ignorance, as he helps to make conscious what is buried in the unconscious. All he can do with a bad habit is to help his patient unlearn it, so that it can be replaced by a better one. Before concluding, I should like to place before you a few facts as an appreciation of the extent of the problem facing contemporary psychiatry. You're probably familiar with the American estimate that one of every 12 children born in the United States today will spend some time in a mental hospital during the course of his life. Here are the latest Canadian figures on the situation. This country has 52 mental hospitals, and most are overcrowded. Along with the 12 hospital schools for the retarded, the psychiatric units in 50 general hospitals and other facilities, over 70,000 Canadians are hospitalized for mental illness of one kind or another. But this is less than 0.5% of the population, and conservative estimates suggest that the actual incidence of psychiatric disability is much higher. Even so, the care of these hospitalized patients cost the country in 1960 over $100 million. Still only about 5% of what we spend on our defense program. And patients no longer languish in mental hospitals. In the course of 1960, 85% of those admitted were discharged back to the community. In fact, the average time spent by a patient in hospital today is less than 3 months. And actually, the chances of recovery of a person suffering a psychiatric illness severe enough to merit treatment in a specialized hospital today have been estimated as better than those of patients with organic disease. Hope has at last taken the place of despair, although much remains still to be done. We've glanced today at some of the basic issues of contemporary psychiatry. In the weeks to come, we shall try to bring to life for you the story of some of the victims of mental illness and the nature of their disabilities. Before I do so, however, I propose to look next week at the history of psychiatry through the ages.
You've been listening to the first of 10 lectures on contemporary psychiatry, given by Dr. John Lovett-Doust, professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto. Dr. Lovett-Doust is consultant in psychiatric research to the province of Ontario, physician and director of the research laboratories at the Toronto Psychiatric Hospital, and director of the Clinical Investigations Unit at the Ontario Hospital in Toronto. The CBC Times for the week of February 1st contains an outline of each lecture in this series. To obtain a copy, write to University of the Air, CBC, Box 500, Terminal A, Toronto. That's University of the Air, CBC, Box 500, Terminal A, Toronto, for a brief outline of each lecture in this series. Next week, Dr. Lovett-Doust will trace the evolution of present-day psychiatry.